I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to Radio Times. Clutter is the hot self-help topic, as evidenced in the popular Netflix series Tidying Up with Marie Kondo. And no wonder. Most of us have a lot of stuff and don't always know what to do with it. Doing some research for the show, I ran across this data. There are 300,000 items in the average American home, which has gotten bigger and bigger over the years. 10% of the U.S. population rents a storage unit to store their overflow. American kids own 40% of the world's toys, even though they are less than 5% of the global population. And as we all know, shopping online when a purchase is just a click away has made it easy, maybe too easy, to buy things that we don't know what to do with once we have them. Well, today on Radio Times, what to do about the clutter in our lives? Why do we hold on to things that we don't use? How do we tackle our messy closets and drawers? And how do we avoid overconsumption in the first place? We have a trio of guests, and here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Darla DeMauro. She's a professional organizer, author of a number of books, including Organizing Your Home with Sort and Succeed. She's got a local TV show called Organizing Elephants, and she's got a company based in Wayne, Pennsylvania called Heartwork Organizing. Darla DeMauro, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
You're very welcome. And joining us from the NPR studios in New York is Julie Morgenstern. She's an organizing and productivity consultant, author of a number of books, including Organizing from the Inside Out, Shed Your Stuff, Change Your Life, and most recently, Time to Parent. I should add, she was a guest on Radio Times when her very first book came out. And Julie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here with you, Marty.
Nice to have you with us. And our third guest is Randy Frost. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College who studies obsessive compulsive disorder and compulsive hoarding. Co-wrote a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things and Buried in Treasures, Help for Compulsive Acquiring, Saving, and Hoarding. In fact, he was a guest on Radio Times when we did a show about hoarding. Randy Frost, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here again.
Nice to have you all with us. And let me just give out the phone number so folks can join the conversation. It's 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Many ways to join our conversation. Let me put something out there. And Julie, let me just start with you. If we're talking about clutter or decluttering, do we have an acquisition problem or do we have a disorganization problem?
I actually think it's neither of the above.
Okay, fair enough.
I think that clutter, first of all, I want to define clutter as any obsolete object or collection of objects. Sometimes it can even be, you know, things on your schedule that just weigh you down or distract you or deplete your energy. They're weighing you down in some way, and they are obsolete. You're not using them. You're not involved with them. You're not touching them. And I actually think clutter is not junk in my experience of working with clients. And it's not just junk that we should be easily able to throw out. I think any collection, any pocket of clutter is what I would call let me put it another way.
Sure.
I call it a point of entry because it is clutter represents an attachment to something we are struggling to release. All clutter represents an attachment to something we're struggling to release. And if you look at the clutter as this point of entry and figure out what is the attachment it represents, it's infinitely more easy to either let it go, replace that intention with something more productive than the clutter, which is actually not achieving the goal. So there's a lot we can learn from our clutter if we slow down and don't just rush to throw it out, but understand the role it's playing in our life. What is this representing so we can unearth it and move forward? It's much more powerful and much more lasting when you approach it that way.
I want to pick up on several things that you just said, and it's interesting. Maybe we should start with the definition of clutter so that we all are on the same page. What's yours, Darla?
Well, I like to think about being organized as being able to find what you need when you need it. And so I don't maybe focus so much on clutter per se, but being able to be organized because when we talk about clutter or when we talk about being organized, it encompasses things and information.
Right.
And time management is also in there as well. So I kind of have this Venn diagram where those three, the clutter, the information, and the time, interact. And a lot of times we're trading time for the information, or we're trading information for clutter. And that where those three interact is kind of the sweet spot, and where they don't interact or overlap, that's where kind of people step back and say, wait, I have this thing, mm-hmm. and it's not helping me organize my information. It's not helping me get my kid to school on time. It's not helping me feel good in a day about what I'm getting done. Is that thing really useful in my life? Is the way I'm spending my time helpful in my life? Is the information that I have on my computer, my phone, the stack of mail in my kitchen, is that helping me get to where I want to be in my life?
And all these things are interconnected. Randy, let me get you in on the conversation, picking up on what both Julie and Darla said. I'm interested in attachment and how we feel about our things, and why for some of our possessions there is so much emotion involved. What is that about?
Well, the emotional attachment to objects really is a fundamental experience of humans. So all of us experience this kind of emotional reaction. We attach something of ourselves, something of our identity, and for us, possessions have a magical quality. Think for a minute about that ticket stub that you save from a favorite concert. There's nothing about the physical properties of that ticket stub that make it any different or any more special than any other ticket stub. But the essence of the experience, the essence of that possession, is what you apply to it, that emotional attachment. And perhaps the best example of the way this happens is was demonstrated by Marcel Proust in one of his pieces, a piece called Remembrance of Things Past.
Sure.
Where he describes the experience of eating a Madeleine cookie as an adult. And what happens when he first tastes and smells that cookie is it brings back the memory of what it was like as a child when his aunt used to make him these cookies. And perhaps the best example that all of us can think of is, what does it feel like when you hear a song from your childhood? It brings back a memory of your childhood, but it's more than that. It's a visceral experience. You feel like you were there. And so what happens with all of us is that these objects bring back an experience that's more vivid than simply thinking of the experience or remembering the experience. And that's one of the things that gives it such an emotional tinge.
Sure. There's something about that memento that is filled with memory and experience. Julie, let me go back to you, and you talk about obsolete objects. And the idea is that if this thing does not serve one's life, is it worth saving? Can you dig into that?
Yeah. So, first of all, again, anything that you're not using, right, that's sort of stagnant. I feel like when we work with clients, that's what we look for. What is stagnant? What closets, what piles, what shelves have things on them that you're not actually using? But because it can represent an attachment you're struggling to release, the answer isn't always to automatically toss it. So I worked with a client who was a corporate executive, and she one day walked into her job and they fired her. It was sort of just like they were just cleaning out from the top. Anybody paid a certain amount or above basically got the boot. And she was so stunned, and this was sort of a forced transition in her life. And I spoke to her on the phone the day that this happened, and she went around and looked for all the stagnant places. And here was what was interesting. One half of her closet, she had not touched in something like 10 years.
Wow.
The other half of her closet, she wore stuff all the time. And I said, well, describe what's in each side. The side that she used was what she called her corporate uniform. It was white, black, beige, and brown.
I can see it.
And the side she hadn't touched in over 10 years was all of her colorful clothes. And instead of saying, because you haven't used that in 2 years or 6 months, throw it out, actually, That was a part of herself that she put on hold to fit into the corporate track. And what we ended up doing was getting rid of the black, brown, white, beige clothes and spread out her expressive clothes, her creative side, and it completely freed her. And she ended up losing like 50 pounds within the year, and she started her own business a year later. I mean, so figure out what that stuff is before you just willy-nilly apply rules to throw it out.
Well, Darla, and speaking of rules, I'm not a rule person, and I don't get the feeling that the three of you are either. But what I hear is it can be a painful experience to go through what does something mean to someone. Why have I held on to it? What is the value? What is the memory embedded in this, whether it's a ticket stub or a teddy bear?
I think, riffing on what Julie just mentioned, I completely agree. People do get focused on the getting rid of stuff. And we as professional organizers, as a community, as professionals, are actually, despite what you see on TV, we're not about making people give things up. We're not about pain, you know. We're really about helping them make room for, I like to say, make room for miracles. So if you're hanging on to things, you know, you might have heard before, if you're holding something with a tight fist,
right. That
means you don't have an open fist or an open hand to receive those miracles. So I've had the same kinds of situations that Julie's describing, you know, over and over again, where somebody, they decide it's time. They call a professional organizer. We go in. We're helping them reorganize, not because we say to get rid of things. That's actually not what we do. That's not our job. It's their stuff. We're coming in and we're coming to support them in what their goals are. So I've had many, many instances where we come to organize a closet, for example, and they end up losing weight, or we end up going in to organize an office, and that person takes on a new role at work or finishes a scrapbooking project that's been stagnant for years. So making room in your home can make room for new experiences, and that is so exciting, and it's so gratifying for us.
And a less painful way to think about what we've been talking about.
It is actually focusing on the fun stuff. Yeah, we're not asking people, hey, what can you throw out? We're asking, what do you want? What do you want out of life, and how can I help you, you know, get there?
Well, we are talking about clutter or decluttering, and in many ways, the psychology of why we hold on to possessions, what they mean for us, and do they really make our lives better. That's Darla DeMauro. Also with us, Julie Morgenstern and Randy Frost. All three of them have interesting different ideas about how to think about this stuff in our lives. And again, you can join us, 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes to join our conversation. An email from Teresa: it's very strange. If I look at my stuff, it looks normal. But if I see it in a picture, it looks like a mess. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen, and we're talking about when clutter becomes a problem. How do we get control of our stuff? And why do we become so attached to our possessions, which makes departing with them, I should say, so difficult? Talking with Randy Frost. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College. Julie Morgenstern, an organizing and productivity consultant. And Darla DeMauro, a Philadelphia-based professional organizer. Randy, let me take Teresa's comment, which I thought was really interesting. It's very strange. If I look at my stuff, it looks normal. But if I see it in a picture, it looks like a mess. And I remember my interview with you about hoarding and how people cannot see what it is that is in front of them. Help us understand how that denial works.
Well, what we see, especially in more serious hoarding cases, is a phenomenon when people are in their homes have sort of filled up gradually, and they've gotten used to it. They've, in a sense, habituated to that environment. But when they look at those things, each of those individual objects in the pile gives them a sense of comfort for the most part. Sometimes it varies, but there's something about having it that makes them feel comfortable. And looking at a picture of your environment, it's a little bit like seeing it through someone else's eyes. I know one of the first hoarding cases I had, the client told me, she said, you know, when you're here, that is when I show up at her house, she said, I feel horrible when I look at all this stuff. But when you're not here, it doesn't bother me at all. And I feel okay.
Yeah, because she doesn't see it or experience what you were experiencing.
She doesn't see it through my eyes. She doesn't see it as a mess. She sees it as these valuable objects, these treasures that she's collected. And any one of them, picking up any one of them and trying to get rid of it, is intensely painful for her. And it's almost as though it feels to her like this is a piece of her, almost as though it's physically connected. And so getting rid of it feels like she's being somehow physically assaulted.
The idea of treasures is an interesting one, Julie. And I mentioned the teddy bear. I have a 60-year-old teddy bear that I had when I was a kid. It's in my room. You know, I know no one is going to want this teddy bear. It's not a problem per se, but it gives me great joy to see that little guy every morning.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there are treasures, and we do, as Randy said, have visceral reactions to objects. And if they do bring you energy and they do make you happy and help with and don't bog you down and you have access to them, like you have this teddy bear, you don't have all of the stuffed animals that you had when you were a kid. You have this one teddy bear that is symbolic and it holds all of those memories for you. And when people are struggling with sentimental objects, mm-hmm. And are stuck, the key is you want to hold on to the things that do bring you energy, but not every object. And I think one of the best questions to ask oneself when you're sorting through sentimental objects is this the best reminder I have of that time in my life or that person who I knew and lost? Is this the best reminder? It's not, is it a reminder, because there are so many of those, but is it the best? And I remember working with this one woman who had a house full of stuff, and she was very sentimental, and she had stuff from her parents who she had lost. And we were going through her home, and she pointed to a table in the hallway. She said, oh, well, I can't get rid of that. That was my parents. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, is that the best reminder you have of them? And she said, oh, God, no, they hated that thing.
Humans are complicated people, are they? Are
we? Yeah. So she was like, oh, right. I don't need to keep that. I have other good reminders, other truly symbolic reminders. And that'll get you down to like the one teddy bear, right, or the one box, or just the things that are the best reminders and not every single reminder. We don't need every single piece.
Here's an email from Gary speaking to this. Darla, I'll put this to you. He says, I say this from painful experience. To seniors, keep in mind that upon your passing, your clutter may become a massive headache for your children. And there is this question about if we're trying to shed our stuff, where does it go? Do we want to just fill up landfills with our old teddy bears and side tables?
Well, that is a problem for today's, especially homeowners and that sandwich generation. You know, a lot of us are still holding on to things that our kids had in the house, but they're in college and transition or have moved on to a new house, and we haven't quite passed that stuff
no,
on
we
to
haven't.
Them yet. And then at the same time, we're losing the older generation. So it's not just family, not just parents a lot of times. It'll be aunts and uncles that pass things on to their nieces and nephews too. And so you'll end up with a couple of households worth of stuff in one house. So it is a problem. But that may be a situation. And again, we see this all the time. That's a situation where a family or a person isn't necessarily cluttered. I mean, we're not, you know, this isn't all just hoarding, right? You don't have to be a hoarder to end up with an organizing problem. And so you're the one in the middle who's holding creating stuff for the next generation who's received stuff from the last generation, yeah, you have to pick and choose. And, you know, like we were saying about your sweet little teddy bear, that's what makes us human. Like my mom always used to say, God, it would be so boring if we were all the same. So, you know, I'm glad that we have these different interests, these different reminders of who we are individually.
Here's an email from Francesca who writes, I realize that I'm hesitant to get rid of things because I don't want to contribute to pollution or waste. My husband and I compost. We try to upcycle and bring our own bags to the supermarket, but there's always some other form of waste. Half the time, I don't know the best way to get rid of things. I recently read that even here in Philadelphia, about 50% of the city's recyclables are burned. I mean, there is a question, Randy. This is a less sort of psychological question, probably more sociological, which is that we just have a lot of stuff. We have access to a lot of stuff. If we hold on to it or we keep buying it, we are going to get buried, maybe alive. I don't know.
Absolutely. And in fact, this is something that we're looking at now with respect to hoarding cases. What we see in some of the most difficult hoarding cases is not only this sentimental attachment, this emotional attachment to things, but a large number of people with hoarding problems who do not have an attachment to their possessions, but they can't get rid of them because they are overly scrupulous about how to do it, that they can't let go of something unless they find a good home for it. And in many ways, this is a pro-social attitude. This is something we should all be more cognizant of, because you're right, our landfills are filling up, and it could be a major issue as time goes by. But this is one of the features we see sometimes, that clutter builds up in a house not because someone's attached to the things, but they can't responsibly get rid of them. And the sense of responsibility leads them to feel guilty if they get rid of something in a way that harms the environment.
Well, it's interesting. We're talking now about clutter and having too much stuff. And of course, Julie, we live in a world where there is scarcity you know, the frustration is sort of how do you take all this plenty and figure out where it should legitimately and rightly go?
Yeah. One of the things that can be done is to think of swaps. So people have talked about like clothing swaps. I think most people are familiar with, you know, a bunch of women get together and they all bring the clothes they don't want anymore and they throw them on the floor and a big pile with a mirror and everybody just leaves with whatever they want. You know, it's like one man's treasure, another's trash or whatever. And then the rest gets donated. So if you do that in a community, you can do that with stuff as well. And then the burden, first of all, some of your stuff actually gets sort of transferred to other people in your community or your group. And then the group itself can organize the research. Where can we ship off books that nobody wants? Where can we ship off kitchen things? Where can, you know, there are furniture that people don't want. And so the communal act of trading and then researching and donating can be very powerful, bring us back to community and connection, and actually be responsible that stuff doesn't, that's perfectly useful, doesn't end up just in trash and landfills. So there are ways around it.
Which is tapping into our social needs as well, that somehow doing in a group has a bigger impact. Darla, let me read something that Beth asks, which is, I think, related to what we're talking about. She says, what advice can your guests give when an adult child is decluttering an elderly parent's home?
Right. So I think the first thing is to just take the handful of treasures. You know, if assuming that that parent has passed on, that's probably where that question is coming from. But to go through and very selectively, and this is really hard to do because you have an attachment to probably almost everything in that environment. But to selectively say, these are the things that I feel good about, that bring me good memories. You don't want to take everything indiscriminately because they don't all have good memories attached to them. But then to bring those home, and most importantly, to find a way to use them in your daily living. not to bring them home and to put them into cold storage, right? To rent a storage unit or to throw them in the basement where they are going to get moldy. Here in our area, we have basements.
Yes, we do.
But they do bad things to your stuff over time. So to bring home just those few treasures and then to make a plan to get the other useful items out into the world. Now, I'm the organizer who says, I want you to stop decluttering. And by that, I mean, think about what's coming into your home so that you don't have to declutter and declutter and declutter constantly in the rest of your life. And so whether you're standing in Target or whether you're having to take care of, dispose of a family member's estate, you know, the people who really know how to pass things on are thrift stores.
Hmm.
There is a secondary market for goods. And I hear people so often say, oh, I don't want to give my stuff away. It's too nice. You know, I don't want to give it to Goodwill. I don't want to give it to the, here in the area, we have Green Drop. You know, I don't want to give it to those people because it's too good. Well, if that...
I mean, that's the perfect reason to
exactly,
do it.
Exactly. If that leather jacket rots in your closet, which I have seen so many times, right? I have a couple who say, oh, we've both got leather jackets from high school. We have not, and we have not worn them in decades, nor are we going to be able to ever wear them again. But in the meantime, that leather jacket could be keeping somebody warm. So what's your choice?
Randy, let me put something else here on the table having to do the connection between clutter and procrastination. Help us understand that link.
Well, one of the things that we see, one of the information processing problems that's associated with hoarding and with many people who struggle with clutter is the difficulty with processing information in such a way that you take the information in, you manipulate it, and then you come to a conclusion. And that process of decision making is influenced by a variety of things, by attention. We see a lot of ADHD or attention deficit problems associated with clutter and hoarding, issues related to memory, and the ability to categorize. Now, one of the things that's quite interesting is people with hoarding difficulties have difficulty categorizing. All of us live our lives categorically. That is, we get an electricity bill and we put it in a file that's a larger category of, say, utility bills. And when we want to find that individual item, we go to the category and look for it. Well, people who struggle with hoarding and organizing possessions seem to operate with a different level of organization. Their organization is more visual and spatial. So that electricity bill might go on the pile of things in the middle of the room, a little over to the left, and they create a mental map in their head of everything in that pile. So if they want to find that bill, they remember where it is in space, in that three-dimensional image they have in their mind. And that's where the organization breaks down. I do this a little bit on my desktop. I think most people do, but in a limited way, it's okay. But if you do that with everything you own, it becomes unmanageable. And that's part of the challenge of organizing for people who have clutter problems.
Julie, how much do you think bins would solve what we've been talking about?
bins and closets, bins and bookcases,
whatever.
Yeah, I mean, bins, I always think of containers as the last step of the organizing process, not the first, even though it will certainly contain visually very quickly. You can sort of get things tucked away. But you have to be careful not to just be taking all the miscellany and putting it in a bin. Or Randy's talking about that visual memory, those visual tactile sort of imprint, and that's where my... You know, where my scotch tape is, it's on top of the TV. Like, right. I just know it's there. What I do think will help is to help those people from an organizational standpoint who have trouble categorizing, to think of each room and think of it in activity zones. That was sort of the principle of organizing from the inside out, which is in each room we do a series of activities, usually 3 to 5 activities per room. In our bedroom, we sleep, we get dressed, we may read. In our kitchen, we cook, we prep, we wash. And if you define the activities that take place in the room, then you group all of the objects by activity and you create activity zones.
Hmm.
And then there's a logic to where things go. that's not just a visual memory, but, oh, all of my reading stuff is in the reading corner. All of the entertainment stuff is in the entertainment zone. And then you can get to the containers. So I usually recommend starting with activity zones. Different framework, but often will work for people who had trouble categorizing before.
Darla, is the goal to have a perfectly organized sock drawer?
Oh, absolutely not. It's funny you talk about the sock drawer, because I talk about the sock drawer all the time. No, the goal is to be able to find what you need when you need it. And the goal is to be able to make sense of where you put things. I often tell people, don't use your house the way the builder intended. Use it the way you need to use it. And so one of the things that I do with clients is just literally talk through, okay, what is this? How do you use it? When do you use it? Do you need it? Do you want it? There's, you know, just some basic questions that as humans, we have these things inside of our head and they kind of rattle around. And once they make it out of our mouths, they make a lot more sense or not to us. Yeah, so saying socks go in a sock drawer. Oh, wait, I don't actually have a sock drawer. Let me take this drawer and make the left of it, left side of it, be for socks, you know. But I wanted to mention that a lot of, you know, you were asking about bins. Bins aren't the answer. If you go to Target and you buy 20 plastic bins and you bring them home, your home doesn't look organized. It looks like an aisle in Target.
Right.
But one of the reasons that people keep things and put them in bins is they think they have spent money on them, so they need to keep it. But one of the things that I say to clients all the time is keeping something longer doesn't make it cheaper, and it never will.
Keeping something longer will never make it cheaper, and it never will.
Yeah.
Interesting. Let's take a very short break and we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about clutter. We're talking about bins, the psychology of clutter, why we hold on to things, why it's hard to let go of things. And that's Darla DeMauro. She's a professional organizer here in the Philadelphia area. Julie Morgenstern is an organizing and productivity consultant. And Randy Frost is a professor of psychology at Smith College who studies obsessive compulsive disorder and compulsive hoarding. We got lots of people that want to join our conversation. You can call us 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us. Much more to talk about after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about the psychology of clutter, how it can lead to stress and dissatisfaction, procrastination, how to organize the stuff in our lives, and how to have stuff that makes our life meaningful, that gives us value and joy. And again, talking with Randy Frost, Julie Morgenstern, and Darla DeMauro. Randy, let me turn to you, and I just have a question about how couples then would navigate through, you know, there's the sort of typical odd couple, there's the neat Nick and the slob. But how do you suggest couples kind of navigate through this acquisitiveness, but also when it becomes a problem within the relationship?
Well, this is one of the sad things about problems. When they get serious, clutter and hoarding problems, what we find is that the frequency of marital conflict is extremely high in hoarding cases, and people with hoarding disorder are more likely to have either never formed any kind of permanent relationship with someone, or their relationships have fractured and broken up. The ones that have been successful are ones where people are able to negotiate areas of the home where the clutter will be abated a bit. So the other kind of successful or partially successful relationship is where one person acquiesces to the other. Usually it's the person who doesn't have the hoarding or clutter problem acquiesces and lets the house fill up, and they suffer sort of in silence in a way.
But is you use clutter and hoarding in the same sentence, but those are two very different things, are they not, Randy?
They are different things, yes. They are related, but they are different things. Clearly, one of the major sources of dysfunction in hoarding disorder is the clutter. But there's a little more dysfunction. Hoarding disorder, there is significant acquisition in 90 to 95% of the cases. So there's often financial difficulties and so forth. In hoarding disorder, there are also lots of other comorbidities, a lot of depression, a lot of attention deficit problems, a lot of anxiety disorder problems. So those are the things that sort of complicate it when it gets it to the level of being a disorder.
Diana asks, how long do you keep clothes that don't fit you anymore, hoping you'll fit into them sometime soon? A very practical question. Julie, do you have an answer to that?
Yeah, I think if your weight does literally go up and down with great regularity and you know that you're going to cycle back down into those 8s and then back up to your 12s and it's a pretty predictable pattern, then just keep the clothes that current size in your closet. Put everything away by size and then just rotate in and out. I think, however, if you had that weight on for a long time and you're really hoping, you know, you're going to get there, you have to ask yourself, are those clothes even going to be sort of fashionable by the time they fit, right? And unless the clothes are really like classic, timeless clothes that are going to look good in 10 years or 5 years, I'd say just get them out, as Darla said, get them out into the world for better use and free your space and the guilt. Because hanging on to that stuff, talk about the psychology. Having clothes in your closet that don't fit makes getting dressed every day a self-criticism. Oh. You just feel bad. It's like, wow, I'm not where I want to be. It's a terrible feeling. And if you just remove those clothes and all that's in your closet is what fits and looks good on you, it's scary to do that because you feel you're acquiescing to, I'm never going to lose the weight. But you have a counter effect, which is sort of accepting yourself and not beating yourself up every day. And you get so much buoyancy. I've seen it over and over again. You may end up losing the weight if you get that stuff out and stop being so self-critical every day.
That's so interesting that seeing the things that don't fit, Darla, is a reminder that they don't fit.
Yeah.
That you're not the person that you used to be or thought you were.
Absolutely agree. You know, in the book Sort and Succeed, it's a 5-step system to organize anything. And the last step is succeed and celebrate. And people don't think about celebrating when they organize something, but it's a very important part of the step. It's sort of closing the book on an organizing project and finishing strong and being able to celebrate. And when I run into people with wardrobe issues like that, I say, look, you know, get to the end of your organizing project and then celebrate by purchasing one or two outfits that make you feel fabulous today.
As a reward.
As a reward.
Start small. I mean, let's say, you know, it's more than just a messy closet. It's a messy house.
Yeah. Start small. Because, again, you want to feel successful. If you say, I'm going to organize my entire house today, look, you can come into my house and it's, you know, that's going to be a big job and it's already organized. So somebody who's sort of starting from behind a wall of clutter is going to be having a hard time with that. But just a 15-minute project. It could be one kitchen drawer. The junk drawer is a great high satisfaction project to take on. Or like Randy said, just look at your desk, right. You know, just your desktop. People say, oh, I'm going to go organize my office. Well, that could take all day or it could take days. But you can certainly pick one corner of the kitchen counter, just one, not the whole kitchen counter, just where the mail usually lands, and start there, start at the other end.
Do you want to add to that, Julie, as an organizing consultant?
Yeah, I think when you're going to organize, which is to create a system, then starting in a small space that you spend the most amount of time in is the best way. So the bathroom is actually a great place, or your purse, because you're in them all day, every day. And so, you know, a 2 hours of organizing, you're going to feel benefit all day, every day. That'll motivate you. I think when you're decluttering, which is getting rid of the old, I actually recommend the opposite, which is start with a category that takes the most amount of space but that you have the least emotional attachment to.
Such as?
Sometimes it's like old dining serving ware that's in your basement that, you know, you have not used that stuff in 25 years. You know you're not going to. you're really not that emotionally attached to it. You let that go. So if you or your Tupperware, you know, your collection of plastic containers. And which
You've
is taking up
around
three
my
cabinets.
There, right?
Yeah. And it takes up like a whole cabinet or two. And you really could get down to like three or five pieces and let the rest go. The least emotional attachment. Because when it comes to decluttering, if you open up a big space, it gives you so much energy and so much freedom and so much power that you then can start slowly tackling things that you have a little more emotional attachment to.
Interesting. Here's a very psychological question for you, Randy. Brian writes, clutter is a, quote, mother substitute. When a mother or caregiver leaves an infant, they can easily become upset by the disappearance of their primary caregiver. To compensate and comfort for this sense of loss, they imbue some object with the attributes of the mother. This is Donald Winnicott's theory and idea. What do you say in response to that? Do you see that?
Well, we have looked a little bit at the question of whether there is some kind of connection between people who develop hoarding problems and early material deprivation of some kind. That is, lots of people assume that if people lived through the Holocaust or through the Great Depression, that was a precursor to the development of hoarding. And we found no evidence that that's the case. In fact, most of the studies looking at early experiences and their connection to hoarding have not shown us very much. There is one caveat, however. We have some data suggesting that an early family environment that is characterized by low levels of warmth and attachment may be one of the backdrops for the development of hoarding. But as far as the scientific evidence goes, it's pretty limited right now in terms of being able to predict who's going to develop this problem.
Darla, we were talking before going on the air about a behavioral economist who has an interesting theory about, acquisition and loss.
Yeah. So I follow Richard Thaler. He was a Nobel Prize winner a couple years back, and his book is called Misbehaving, The Making of Behavioral Economics, or I think he said somewhere, Why We Do the Dumb Things We Do. Anyway, so he talks about the endowment effect, and this is what he and his team won the Nobel Prize on. And basically, it's the idea that once you own something, it then becomes more valuable to you than the same item that somebody else owns. So that's a very human behavior.
Sure.
It's hardwired. It's prehistoric. You know, it's what happens, so that we kind of have to work. We have to know this to work against our brain to say, no, wait, it's just a coffee cup, not an NPR cup of coffee.
Of course not.
It's just a coffee cup. It's not more valuable than the coffee cup that was sitting next to it on the store shelves. But at the same time, we also have to recognize that this is it's hardwired in the brain.
It's about survival, isn't it?
It really is. So he's actually demonstrated that losses hurt the brain roughly twice as much as gains feel good. So even though we're working towards making change and wanting something positive, we physically are still feeling the loss of something. And so, you know, once you're aware of that, you can actually sort of say to your brain, you know what, I'm going to use my big girl brain today, and I'm going to make this good decision that's going to help my future self, you know.
Julia, a way of sort of reframing what feels like loss, it sounds like.
Yeah, I think so. I think one of the keys that we all have to keep in mind before we tackle any clutter in our lives, to let go. Letting go of things is the hardest, most painful thing in the world for people to do. It's harder than organizing, setting up a system. Right. It's just letting go. But if we recognize that no one lets go into a vacuum. No one lets go of anything without reaching for something else. And so I think before you declutter any aspect of your life or your home, ask, I call it naming a theme. Name a theme, come up with a word of what you are making space for. And I don't mean objects. I mean what experience, what part of you do you want to express? You know, connections, you know, for somebody who might feel isolated, they want to make room for connections or freedom or creativity or financial security. right? Like in the acquisition, I want to make space for financial security. And when you define that theme, it gives you something to reach for and measure as you're looking at something. What's worth more to me, this object or the space for financial security or the space for human connection or the space to express my creative side? It makes it a lot easier to let go because you're reaching for something very positive and desirable.
Let me read a couple of comments here. Zoe writes, I wonder, what about books? As a rare book dealer, I see collecting trending toward material objects. I have shelves crowded with so many books, I'm not sure I'll ever get to reading them all. And as a neat person and Marie Kondo enthusiast, my only problem with her philosophy is that books fall into the clutter category. But then Ruth says, I inherited a storage unit full of my parents' books. They were scholars and voracious readers. A few were valuable, but books generally aren't valuable these days. I was inspired by the tiny libraries in cities. I've seen them where it's just a little on a little shelf.
Little free libraries.
Yeah. You know, on the side of the street where people can lend and borrow books from each other. But I think books, Darla, can be overwhelming and they're heavy.
Yeah. Look, books or anything else, it's only a problem if it's a problem.
Right.
Right. So if you have a huge library, home library or wherever, and you have space for those books and you enjoy them, and you are safe, meaning that they're not piling up on the floor so that you don't have a safe exit to and from your spaces in your home, then they're not a problem, right? So, you know, we have this social media generated view of how our homes should look these days. But if you're a bookworm and that gives you great joy, then be a bookworm, for God's sake.
And have books on the floor.
Absolutely. Right? You know, we can store books a dozen different ways in your home other than a bookshelf.
Randy, let me read a comment from Mark who writes, one of the tools that my sister and I used to get past the sentimental barrier to keeping physical things while cleaning out our mother's house was to take photos of each of these things. We put together a scrapbook so that we could have the memories and the emotional attachment, but we weren't overwhelmed with all of that stuff. It seems like a very clever and responsible way to deal with that. Your thoughts, Randy?
I think for most people, that will work. For people with hoarding disorder, however, there seems to be some kind of effect of having a tangible object. When we've tried to use pictures with people who suffer from hoarding disorder, it doesn't work very well. Mm-hmm. They seem to need the tangible object. And in some cases, having it available to touch or to see has some kind of an effect that goes well beyond what the effect a picture can have.
Bob suggests I put a table on my curb on which I put unwanted items for people to take, and take them they do. I take any useless items like metal or old electronics to the scrapyard and get paid for them. Visit your local scrapyard, Bob suggests. Jill says, just thinking about clutter makes my brain hurt. It feels stuffed, cluttered, crowded. I have ADHD, diagnosed 8 years ago when I was 60. Knowing why keeping things organized has been so difficult has helped me to recognize when things get out of hand. It's still difficult to maintain organization, but now I have awareness and tools. And I guess in many ways, Julie, we're almost out of time here. Awareness and tools, that can get you a lot in life.
Yes. I think the key is no one should throw their hands up and surrender. If you feel like you are disorganized and want to get organized, or you feel cluttered and you want to get rid of stuff, there are processes and tools and people and resources that can help you. And start small and get something done. You'll feel better at the start of the new year.
Well, Julie Morgenstern, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she joined us from the NPR studios in New York. She's an organizing and productivity consultant. Her most recent book is Time to Parent. Randy Frost, thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College, co-author of Stuff and also Buried in Treasures. And Darla DeMauro, thank you for coming in and joining us on Radio Times.
Thank you for arranging to have me on.
There you go. She's a professional organizer, author of a number of books, including most recently, Organizing Your Home with Sort and Succeed. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, sign up for our listener page on Facebook as well. Diana Martinez, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you for joining us.